Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. This is a day we talk about recent data sets in the management of multiple myeloma. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Joseph McHale from the Translational Genomics Research Institute and City of Hope Cancer Center in Phoenix, and Dr. Ajay Nuka from the Winship Cancer Institute at Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by your faculty, just type them into the chat room. We'll get to as many of these as we can. As always, we have a brief one-minute survey at the beginning and end of this exercise. If you take it, you'll get a lot more out of this meeting. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. If you're into audio programs, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program with Dr. Krishnan on BCMA-directed therapies. This is part of our year in review series that we do every January. Tomorrow we'll continue with another program on targeted therapy of non-small cell lung cancer. So much there to talk about, hard to even get through in an hour. We're about to head out to San Francisco to the GI Cancer Symposium. We'll be doing three symposia out there. If you're in the San Francisco area, drop one in. For everybody else, we'll be doing this online as well. So the next Wednesday, we have a great faculty talking about colorectal cancer, Thursday, gastroesophageal cancer, and Friday, hepatobiliary cancer. So much going on there. We'll be presenting a bunch of video cases from docs in practice. And then January 24th, we'll be reviewing what's been going on in the past year with gynecologic oncology, PARP inhibitors in ovarian cancer, and more. But today we're here to talk about multiple myeloma. And as we do in this series, I met with both of our faculty over the last couple weeks and recorded an in-depth presentation that we're going to select some papers for to discuss. But I met with both of the faculty, and we talked about a lot of papers from the ASH meeting. Dr. McHale reviewed a bunch of papers related to upfront treatment, and Dr. Nuka, papers in relapse disease and new strategies, including bispecifics and CAR-T. So we're going to kind of dip into that whole thing over the next hour. But before we start, just wanted to get the faculty's take. We actually started talking about this over the last 20 minutes in the faculty rehearsal. So it's kind of a debate we started. We're going to continue, which is, you know, very dramatic, Joe. We've had two drugs recently that were approved, that people out in practice were using, getting used to using, and all of a sudden they're pulled off the market from the FDA. We'll see whether they're even going to come back. Here are the press releases end of November and then the beginning of December. Any thoughts about this development? I hear docs, you know, who've got patients on belantamab doing well. They're arranging to get the drug, but they're kind of trying to understand why a drug that, you know, has a pretty good response rate and maybe 30-35% is not going to be available anymore. What's your take on it? What do you think? And how does this feel to you, Joe?
Oh, thanks, Neil. It's always great to be with you, my friend. It's a pleasure. Well, I think starting with belantamab, I think as we were discussing a little bit before, I don't think this is the end of belantamab. We saw such an impressive, as you mentioned, single agent response. The confirmatory trial did not meet its endpoint, but there are other trials ongoing. And for those clinicians who are taking care of patients right now with belantamab, of course, they're registered in a REMS program. There is an opportunity actually to continue the drug. And frankly, actually, Neil, to introduce new patients to the drug through an expanded access program. Now, that requires some communication with the company. There has to be IRB approval, either through an individual IND or a larger expanded access program consent. But nonetheless, it can be done. Obviously, it takes more time. It's a little bit more challenging. There are some hoops to jump through. But we do see so many patients benefit from this drug. And interesting, a lot of them are not very frequently getting treated because the drug continues its response over long period of time, but they're still in response. So I do think we haven't heard the end of the belantamab story. When it comes to melflufenamide or melflufen, I'm still think that's a little bit up in the air. It's tough to say. That trial was really quite convincing that there were some concerns about this drug. It may be beneficial in certain subsets, but we would need a lot more data for it to make a resurgence.
So, Ajay, I'm curious about your thoughts on this. You know, I don't try to figure out the FDA. I know they have a tough job to do. There's a lot of other issues in oncology in terms of cost, et cetera. We tend to focus on, you know, the clinical science. But from that point of view, I guess one of the issues is it reasonable to, you know, use an agent, a new agent, based on a single-arm trial, or do you need randomized data? Clearly, and very, very rare, you know, we're talking tomorrow about lung cancer. Some of these mutations, you know, are very rare, and you're never going to do a randomized study on them. But, you know, relapsed myeloma, there are quite a few patients. Any thoughts, AJ? You know, you have a lot of people, you've got patients on belantamab that seem to be benefiting. What about the role of patient-reported outcomes? We're seeing more of that put into the design of trials. Do you feel better if not only do you see activity, you know, responses, you know, objective evidence, but also patient-reported, patients telling you they feel better and reported in a scientific way? Any thoughts, Ajay?
Thanks for having me, Neil. That's a packed question. So the way that the current process goes on with the drug development is, it's not foolproof, but it is a good way for us to get the drugs under the accelerated approval programs. So if you take the example of daratumumab, it got approved as a single agent based on the single agent activity of less than 30%. You take the example of belantamab, the same exact 31% or so, selinexor. But daratumumab, based on the confirmatory trials that followed, has attained the approval. Similarly, selinexor attained a full approval based on the confirmatory trials as well. So the process works. So we're able to get the drug earlier to the patients. So what could be tweaked a little bit are the confirmatory trials. It's not that belantamab does not have activity. It has great activity, and we all have examples of patients that continue to derive those benefits in the long run. So the pre-specified endpoints were the ones that were not met. The study design has so much of an importance that needed to be really taken into consideration when the confirmatory trials are designed. And you bring in a great point in terms of how to incorporate the PROs, the patient-related outcomes, into these trials. So it is not just the efficacy that you're looking at if you're looking at another bar comparing to another comparator, but how to incorporate those PROs into this approval process, and even that will help us to deliver the drugs based on the PROs as well.
So, Joe, I was kind of flashing back. There used to be a thing called TWIST, I think, in breast cancer, time without symptoms or something like that. You know, I guess it was the first attempt to really look at patient-reported outcomes. I put in another point here related to this, and I was thinking about it a lot when Ajay was doing his presentation on bispecifics, because he was saying, you know, there's a concern about increased risk of infection. And, you know, I've heard a bunch of other myeloma people mention that. And, you know, I couldn't really look at the numbers and get the feel for it, but just talking to him, it was almost, I had to interpret how he felt about it. And I got the feeling it was a pretty significant problem. So, but you know, you got maybe bispecific going to come down to a community level fairly soon. How do you figure out when you only have one arm data what the magnitude of a problem is, like, for example, secondary infections, Joe?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it's incumbent on us, and thankfully, because we have, in one way, sadly, been reporting infections in myeloma since, you know, the start of myeloma, we're good at grading those infections and reporting them. But I think part of the strategy has to not just look at the wonderful sticker shock of the response rates of these, but really look at the infections. And in particular, Neil, what may be different here with the bispecifics as they move into the community is that historically in myeloma, as was sadly confirmed during COVID, people's greatest risk of infection was when their disease was the most active. Now, some of the work actually out of Emory, Ajay, in your center has been so helpful in helping us understand this, that the immune dysfunction of having active myeloma puts you at risk of infection. The worrisome feature now is we're seeing these people in deep, deep responses and yet developing significant infections because we're probably overbeating down their T cells. So I think there's going to be an evolution, Neil. Like we don't use almost any drug now the way it first came out in myeloma, right? Bortezomib was IV twice weekly. Carfilzomib was twice weekly. Daratumumab was IV. They've all gone through this evolution that always increased their efficacy and reduced their toxicity. I think that's going to happen here. But your point is very well taken. In a single arm study, it's hard to know because they're typically smaller numbers. And during COVID and other things, it's hard to assess that infection. But I would say that we have to keep infection risk high on our radars as we go forward with these newer treatments, because it's devastating to see a patient with heavily relapsed myeloma get this amazing response and then tragically die of a rare infection. We really want to find ways around that.
So final question about this, Jay, is specifically the issue of COVID. It seems like so long ago, all we talked about was COVID, but it was really only obviously just a couple of years ago. Do you look upon COVID differently than other viral infections? And particularly as it relates to therapies being used in myeloma, is it more of a risk than, you know, other types of infections? And how does it relate to the type of therapy? For example, I've heard people say you see more COVID with bispecifics.
So I would put it in a slightly different way. The immune responses that patients get from the vaccinations are blunted or impaired with specific myeloma treatments. So we had shown from our institution that daratumumab can impair these induction of these immune responses. So what we have routinely talked to the patients and got these patients vaccinated with the boosters, as we go on with increasing those layers of protection and minimizing the risk of having the COVID is the best way to deal with in any such scenario.
All right, well, it's time for some rock and roll. Let's go through as many papers as we can. And of course, we're going to start out with the big paper of the year. Joe actually did the discussion of this in the plenary session of the ASCO meeting, the determination trial, which had an impressive effect on PFS, but no effect on overall survival. And Joe went through these data in his talk. There were a couple of things that we talked about that I kind of didn't really pick up the magnitude of, and I just want to point out. One is the issue of the higher risk patient, Jay, and you see here a greater impact on high risk patients than standard risk patients. So first of all, Ajay, what were your thoughts about determination? Does it change the way you're presenting transplant as an option to patients? And are you more likely to think about it in a high-risk patient?
So you asked two great questions. So number one, what are the take-home messages for me from determination? Number one, transplant still has a role. It met the primary endpoint with a PFS difference of 21 months favoring the transplant arm. Now, if you tease out who are the patients that got benefited the most, you can clearly see the patients who have high risk got benefited from transplant. And for the standard risk patients, they still got benefited from the transplant, but you have an option of delaying for a later time based on what you saw from the overall survival across the board.
Joe, again, you did the discussion, so you were among the first people to really be able to think through the data. Again, how's it changed, if at all, the way you approach patients? You know, we were just talking about, you know, you need a randomized trial that shows a survival benefit, and hey, I don't see it here, and it's not like it's a very easy therapy. I kind of wonder whether there should have been a stronger reaction. You know, I think people are saying, all the docs in practice are saying, well, I send the patient to a transplanter and see what they have to say. But, I mean, should we be recommending upfront transplant, Joe, in a patient with standard risk?
It's a great question, and that's why it divided, you know. Being before I was a discussant, I felt like I was like running for office. I had like, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats all calling me, telling me, you're going to say transplant's good, right? Oh, you're going to say we don't need transplant, right? I mean, like, I was trying to be the most independent I could be, Neil. But you know, joking aside, I think the magnitude of the PFS difference is significant, right? Because we all talk about that. That was the primary endpoint of the study. But pragmatically, in the long run, the fact that there wasn't an overall survival advantage does worry me to a certain extent, especially when we see that really only 28% of people who didn't get the transplant up front got it later, unlike the French trial where 80% of them did. So that study was really, if you will, early versus delayed transplant. And in that way, you could argue it's okay that there's no overall survival difference. So I would have expected more. The other point I really want to make here, and again, I'm not trying to be ageist or exclusionary, but I just came from my clinic, Neil, and I had a patient come in with these curves for determination to ask about her mother, who we're considering a transplant for. But she's 74 years old. Every patient in this trial was 65 years and younger. So if we couldn't demonstrate that benefit then, because as you know, as we get older, respectfully, it's harder for us to show an overall survival benefit. But even in this younger population to demonstrate that, I think the only thing it changes for me is that it is still a very legitimate option. I'm very comfortable delaying transplant in standard risk patients. And often I'm just giving people permission to not have a transplant when they're over the age of 65 and I know they're going to have significant toxicities through it. Maybe what's pushing me a little bit, though, is in that higher risk patient who is close to the age of 65. And again, it's not about age. It's about their performance status and comorbidities and so on. I may be a little bit more keen to proceed with transplant because delaying it may be a problem. They may not be able to get it later or tolerate it later. So that may be the gentle nudge, but I think it's just a reassurance that transplant, as I joked in my commentary, just like any other drug, transplantamab or transplantamib or transplantamide, whatever you want to call it. I mean, at the end of the day, it is just one drug of melphalan, that it should be looked at as an option and not absolutely the default.
And of course, you know, we talk about patient reported outcomes, patient involvement in decision. You know, anytime in oncology, you can invite the patient to participate and actually make the decision. Jay, sometimes I think that some of these trials are almost like the Talmud. The more you read it, the more you see it. But I know when it was first presented, I was kind of wondering, concerned a little bit when you're looking at more in terms of second cancers. So overall, you know, there is an increase in second cancers, but what was most striking was the fact that in the transplant group, there were 10 people with AML and MDS, and in the non-transplant, zero. And actually, I did a program yesterday with Dr. Richard Stone from Dana-Farber, the AML doc, and I said, is there any reason that patients in this type of transplant should have a higher risk of AML or MDS than other people getting a transplant? Because I don't know, it seems, 10 versus zero, kind of interesting. And Ajay, he brought up a very interesting point, which is the post-transplant lenalidomide, which of course, you know, is associated with some modest increase of second cancers. So I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are, Ajay, about this specific finding. How much of a concern?
So it is not surprising for me to see this number. So this is RVD with transplant followed by len maintenance. We've seen the secondary primary malignancies at a rate of around 3%, even from the earlier trials, Phil McCarthy's trial initially, going on to the MRC11 trial. All of those who used maintenance at a later time had reported the secondary primary malignancies. So what this trial had shown was clearly the usage of lenalidomide post-transplant increases the risk of AML. But if you look at the prior row on the same one, the risk of ALL is increased in those patients that did not receive a transplant. So are we saying the transplant is protective of ALL? So it's a give and take when you look at both these scenarios. The risk of ALL is significantly higher among patients that did not receive the transplant. So the bottom line is, yes, the patient has to understand that this is an expected outcome, and the other 97% of the patients do not have those secondary primary malignancies.
Joe, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of ways to try and carve this. I think the simple way to say is, yes, transplant does contribute. Lenalidomide has a risk in and of itself, but transplant does increase that risk of a second primary. And we've known that even before we gave lenalidomide maintenance. And we see it in different realms, often in GU malignancies and in MDS AML situations. It has to remind us, though, that the baseline no matter what someone gets in terms of treatment during their myeloma journey, sadly, there's about a 4 to 5% risk of a second cancer, even independent, if you will, or agnostic to whatever therapy someone has. And that's, you know, related to underlying genetics, yes, to some treatment, but also to the, what I call phenomenon of incidentaloma, right? These people are being followed more closely and we find things that we may not have found before. I think we've historically said, because there's an overall survival advantage associated with lenalidomide maintenance, it sort of outweighs the potential risk. I think what it does, as you said, so important to have that conversation with the patient, those open lines of communication need to be there. And we have to remember, after a transplant or even just on lenalidomide prolonged therapy, are patients getting their mammograms and their colonoscopies, their PSA check, their you know, are they reporting blood in their urine and their stool? Are we checking their CBCs regularly? Are you noticing that the MCV is climbing or the hemoglobin is dropping out of keeping with the myeloma? Those are the kinds of things that are going to help us capture these a little bit earlier. And sadly, they're inevitably to happen in a percentage of patients. But hopefully with time, my goal ultimately is that we don't have people on continuous therapy, because we're going to have such great immune therapies early on. And hopefully that'll have the added benefit of reducing those second primary malignancies.
So I really recommend that you check out the two talks that are part of this program. And Josie has these, Dr. Joe summaries where he, you know, goes through, there's a lot of the points you went through in the original discussion. Let's go through a bunch of other papers. Jay, we saw an update of the Griffin study, DARA RVD. We're seeing a lot of people doing this outside of clinical trial right now. The data continues to look great. Interesting, Joe pointed out, this is a randomized phase two, curious what your thought is nowadays, Ajay, about using a quadruplet therapy. I know, you know, of course, we worked with Sagar a few weeks ago, and he's always been very pro quadruple therapy. What are the situations right now where you're thinking about this, Ajay?
So we use the quadruplet therapy in most patients. In all the standard risk patients, we use DARA plus VRD. In the high risk patients, you probably would replace the V with a K, DARA plus KRD. So, but the NCCN guidelines really have the DARA plus VRD as a standard approach for standard of care approach for the myeloma patients at this point. So how did we get the benefit? So you take the RVD post-transplant, post-consolidation response rates, just from what you saw from the determination trial, is in the range of around 33% stringent complete response rates. You get a 10% more stringent complete response rates with a four-drug regimen with data to be given in addition to RVD. So Joe clearly points down here, what we know for certain is DARA plus VRD is a good regimen. What we do not know for certain is, should we continue daratumumab in the maintenance setting? So I think I use most of a quadruplet regimen in most of the patients over the last 4 years. We'd started to change our practice.
So, Joe, you also talked about the Maya study, DARA-RD, which seems like it's now the most common regimen used in patients who are not going to transplant. It kind of, this update shows a 5-year PFS of 52%, which is really amazing to me. That was higher than I expected it was going to be. Any thoughts about this regimen? I hear some people saying they try, you know, they start out with DRD and then some, maybe they think about sneaking in a little PI later. What's your experience with this regimen? And do you ever try to bring in a PI after you get it started?
A great question, Neil. In fact, I had this conversation just today in clinic. It sounds like everything I did in clinic today is coming to fruition in this talk, but that's just the way it works, right? So first of all, I mean, I think the Maya study is remarkable in these long-term outcomes. And I think a lot of it has to do with the continued synergy of giving DARA and lenalidomide together. And just again, you know, tips to the community oncologists, you know, for most of these patients, we're not giving full dose lenalidomide, right? With time, we turn down the decks. You know, I have a I had a new hashtag at Ash this year, down with Dex, because Dex is like the booster rockets on the shuttle. Great for the first few cycles, but get the dose down because it really hurts people in the long run. And similarly, most of these people, I have so many patients on the Maya regimen, Neil, that are on, you know, their monthly or every 4 week daratumumab, and they're taking 10 and sometimes even 5 milligrams of Len, 3 weeks on, 1 week off. Where I like to squeeze in the PI is potentially in those patients at highest risk, that the high risk patients, even though Maya did demonstrate a benefit in high risk, that may be its slight chink in the armor. So for example, that patient I was referring to today, she has both P53 deletion and translocation 414. So I know that person's at particularly high risk. What I actually do, Neil, instead of bring it in later, I start them on DVRD, just like Ajay said. And it, assuming no neuropathy, I keep them on the bortezomib for 6 cycles. And at the end of the 6 cycles, again, if they don't have neuropathy, what I'll do is I'll turn down the bortezomib to every other week for another 6 months. Because I think we have previous studies to show to us that patients who are not going to transplant can get a year of a PI without too much toxicity if it's done carefully, subcutaneously, weekly for the first 6 months, every other week for the next 6 months. And then they just stay on the daratumumab and lenalidomide indefinitely. And I found that to be particularly helpful because remember, in the SWOG study, even just getting 6 cycles of bortezomib up front had an impact on survival later. So I think those highest risk patients benefit from a PI early on.
So speaking of PIs, Jay, you know, particularly during the COVID, more when COVID was more of a problem, we were thinking about oral therapy, and I was hearing a lot of people bringing up the issue of exazimib. We saw some more data from exazimib, Len, and Dex this past year. And Joe's take, even there's not that many patients, only 42 patients in that. But Joe's take, and you know, I kind of been hearing this in general over the last few years, is that this is really inferior to bortezomib. Not that you shouldn't ever use it. I'm sure there's situations where you know, you really need to use an oral therapy. What's your view about exazimib, Jay?
So exazimib is a PI with an activity, and we had seen it when compared with placebo. So there's no doubt it has activity. But when you compare all the PIs, so if you take the example of carfilzomib, bortezomib, or exazimib, the weakest PI is exazimib. The only attractive option here is the oral intake or the oral administration, where the patient does not need to come in as many times as the patients receiving the PIs, the other PIs do. The second advantage is the risk of neuropathy is slightly lesser compared to the bortezomib, maybe likely to due to the oral administration. So those are the advantages that I see with ICSA. If I need to use a PI, if I understand that the patient is PI sensitive and could benefit could get a response or a benefit from a PI. So this is one of my backup mechanisms, not as a frontline mechanism.
So we're going to talk about anti-CD38 therapy in a second. But question from the chat room, Abdullah, Joe, what about 2 cycles of a consolidation after transplant, as for example, after the Griffin strategy?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Thank you for asking that, Abdullah. I think the short answer is we're incorporating in more and more studies some further consolidation after the transplant for a few reasons. One, because you know, theoretically, we've always had the sense that maybe the disease is a little bit more sensitive after a transplant. You know, somehow the immune system is a bit stunned by the transplant. But also that 4 cycles isn't really the gold standard. For those of us who have enough gray hair or not enough hair in general, can remember the earliest days. Ajay, you were probably still in utero back then, but you know, we would give VAD, right? Where we would give the vincristine and we would give adriamycin and dexamethasone. And we were concerned about the cardiac toxicity. And that's why we didn't want to use more than 4 cycles. But I think we're starting to realize that although we have to be careful with the immunomodulatory drugs and stem cell collection, that we can actually go out to 6 cycles. So my typical approach, Abdullah, is that if someone's received 4 cycles and they've usually gotten a relatively deep response then, and we do a transplant, if they're absolutely in the deepest remission measurable, whether we do MRD or not, let's say they're they're in a complete remission. I have a sit-in conversation with the patient saying, do we really need to give you more of this consolidation? Maybe we should just go straight to maintenance. But if there is still some residual disease there, I'm of the mind that most people tolerate it well. They've already been through a transplant, so it's not too tough to give them a couple cycles of repeat induction and then going into to maintenance therapy. And so I think that's where most of us are landing now. As we get more studies, we'll know more. But last point is that Griffin did show a deeper response after this, those consolidation, that it did actually contribute to the deepening response, although that's a bit diluted by not as many measured it right after transplant.
So speaking of depth of response, so now we've seen a phase three study using isatuximab with RVD, showing an impressive effect on MRD, I think 50% MRD negativity. And I guess, Ajay, this is Joe's take on this quad. I'm curious, so, you know, I think hopefully we'll get the problem solved. We'll talk about this in a second of sub-Q. But any thoughts about whether there seems to be any difference in what you're seeing in this phase three trial than what's been seen in Griffin, Ajay?
So in my opinion, both the CD38 antibodies are exactly the same. And the responses that we had seen are almost similar to what we saw with the data VRD with Griffin and the GMMG study. So the both of them had one common theme, that addition of a CD38 antibody to VRD has resulted in much deeper responses. So that's the take-home message I'll go by. So there is a confirmatory phase three trial to Griffin, which is a Perseus that is ongoing. And even in that study, I'm not expecting anything different. So this would be the same exact results that I would go by.
So Ajay mentioned the GMMG study, isatuximab KRD. Joe, can you comment on what your take is, particularly in terms of, we were talking a little bit before, in terms of quads in higher risk patients and the choice of PI?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think we've known from our historical work in relapse disease that carfilzomib is a more potent proteasome inhibitor. I think almost everybody would agree to that. I think, like I said earlier, with the evolution of drugs, as we become more comfortable using them to increase their efficacy and reduce their toxicity, I think we found that with carfilzomib. I think we're careful now with the fluid, with the dosing, with the frequency of the dosing. So I do think that in particular in higher risk patients that I'm favoring using carfilzomib in the frontline setting. And in fact, I think we can use carfilzomib even in older and more frail patients. We just have to use it a little bit more carefully. I think the other thing that tips us, of course, Neil, is if someone really does have pre-existing neuropathy or if someone has diabetes and is at great risk, a lot of our patients can really suffer with neuropathy. So I try to, as much as possible, steer away from bortezomib in those settings.
What about in the relapse setting, Ajay? Again, another study that Joe discusses in his talk, isa-pom-dex versus pom-dex, showing a significant benefit there. And he brings up the question of using CD38 after a patient's had it. So maybe they've had an induction. Would you consider CD38? Would you, if you are you going to switch the type of CD38. Any comments about, as we use more and more anti-CD38 up front, how it's going to fit in, if at all, in the relapse setting, Ajay?
This is a great question, Neil. So the study is very important for two reasons. Number one, in the later relapse setting, the study showed the addition of a CD38 antibody has resulted in an overall survival. So we have not seen more studies in this space showing that overall survival benefit. So this is really good and sobering to see that benefit extended in this late relapse patients. The second one is I want to differentiate what is exposure versus refractory means. So somebody, we gave examples in the Griffin study, patients would receive data in the upfront setting. And then in the maintenance setting, we're not using data at all. So, however, when the patient relapses, we are still able to use the daratumumab in the relapse setting as well. So these are data-exposed patients. Contrary to that, if somebody is continuously receiving daratumumab or any CD38 antibody, if they're relapsed on the while receiving the active CD38 antibody, and the question of whether we can reuse them with combinations to regain those responses is the biggest question that I don't know the answer to, and I typically don't do as a practice. I'd love to hear Joe's opinion.
So Joe, I'm curious about your thoughts, but also about this other paper. This is maybe my favorite paper that you discuss. I was not aware that there's a sub-Q formulation of isatuximab. It sounds kind of cool. An on-body delivery system presented at ASH. And hear your comments on it. Can you, first of all, maybe give a second opinion in terms of Ajay's approach to using anti-CD38 in relapse disease? And then what about the sub-Q ESA? And that could be practice-changing.
Absolutely. So in terms of CD38, I mean, I agree with what Ajay said. I mean, I actually led the study where we gave isatuximab granted as monotherapy in patients who had relapsed recently on a daratumumab-based regimen. And these drugs are so similar. They're not designed in a way that one is really going to overcome the resistance of the other. So they're so similar, I would not use them immediately sequentially. That being said, we know that if someone's off, you know, a CD38 antibody for 6 months or more, chances are they are going to regenerate some of those CD38 antigens. And so if I had someone in the past, maybe a few relapses ago, treated with Dara, or even up front treated with Dara, and now they've been, you know, off a CD38 antibody for a while, and I really need a partner for a drug, let's say like pomalidomide or other, then I might say, okay, I'll either go back to the same CD38 or maybe there might be a slight advantage of switching to another one like isatuximab. And as for ESA sub-Q, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, we've been waiting for this for a while. I've seen this on-body delivery system. It sounds fancier than it might really be, but you know, it really is convenient for the patient. In some countries, this may be able to be done in their homes, at least after initial few doses. So I do think with time, one of the biggest reasons now, often we favor Dara over ESA, just to be blunt, is that it's a sub-Q injection. It's a much shorter time frame, even though the ESA infusion is shorter than the Dara infusion used to be. So I think once ESA becomes sub-Q, it'll be a lot easier to toggle between these two or to, you know, not have the delivery method a big differentiator between the two of them.
So I was just kind of flashing, Ajay, around when daratumumab first came out, and I was hearing all these stories about people having to be in clinic for 10 hours because of the infusion reaction, and the docs couldn't keep their offices open long enough. And of course, the sub-Q completely changed it. This new formulation sounds really interesting. I'd be curious to see, like, which one, you know, people prefer. Any thoughts about this? And what have you observed and how sub-Q Dara has affected the patient's quality of life and experience, Ajay?
Absolutely. So within the first month of availability of subcutaneous daratumumab, 70% of our patients switched from IV to sub-Q. And the quality of life, the study that we have done, it's a very small study in 100 patients, and the patients loved the sub-Q version of the drug. There's only one patient, I don't know why, but there's only one patient that did not like it. So where we had to go back to the IV formulation. But overall, within the 3 month time frame, 98% of our patients changed from sub-Q to IV. So now from IV to sub-Q. So once we changed to sub-Q, we didn't know how much time to monitor and how much time we needed to see after the first dose, including after giving the pre-medications. So we watched for our data for a period of 1.5 years. And recently we said even that monitoring for the first 3 hours after giving that sub-Q formulation, even after the first dose, is not even necessary. So we changed our practice accordingly. So right now our patients go in 5 minutes of getting the shot, waiting for the labs is the longest period that it takes, and then they go home.
So we go from first gear to second gear here. We're going to talk about CAR T therapy in a second. I want Ajay to talk about this paper presented at ASH looking at IDACEL and MRD. But first, Joe, can you provide sort of an overview of where we are in terms of clinical use of CAR T? So we have two approved preparations in IDACEL and CILTACEL. I'm curious what your take is nowadays, Joe, in terms of the relative efficacy and tolerability issues and other practical issues, and also what the situation is right now in terms of actually being able to access CAR-T, because it seems like it's a huge problem. And really, it's just the question of trying to get either preparation rather than even having a preference. Any general comments?
You made the key point, Neil. It really is. It's access. You know, I'm not making light of it, but it was like in the middle of the pandemic, you didn't care what toilet paper you found. You just wanted to find toilet paper, right? I mean, Costco had sold out and you're spending ridiculous amounts of money getting it. Again, I'm not trying to make light of a serious topic, but you know, it really is still very hard to get slots for CAR-T. And now I'm sure we're going to get to bispecifics later, even more so with bispecifics right now. And so, yes, there are relative differences, of course, between ide-cel and cilta-cel, both in efficacy and in their toxicity profile. But right now, I think if a patient is CAR-T eligible, I'd be happy to get them either one of them, if you will. It's not like I favor one so much over the other that we're in a position to choose in that way. I think in the long run, we'll have more choices. And frankly, in the long run, like with every other drug, we're going to find ways to make it more effective. Right now, unfortunately, there are a lot of people waiting for CAR-T. I think we have gone through a bit of evolution where it used to be that we kind of saved CAR-T for someone who has literally had nothing else. It was like the Hail Mary pass. I think we've realized that's probably not the best stewardship of that resource, and we want to use it appropriately, and each center is finding a way to do that more effectively. I think we're going to see more CAR-T availability over this next year as some of the supply chain issues resolve, as more centers are coming on board. But it's going to take a while, Neil. It's not going to be available overnight.
So, Ajay, let's talk a little bit about this ASH paper looking at MRD and ide-cel. Can you talk a little bit about what they looked at there and what you think it means?
Yeah. So Bruno Paiva's group, who are pioneers in the next generation flow from Europe, so they were able to look at the samples from the patients that received the CAR-T as a ide-cel as a part of the CARMA 2 trial. So there were 128 patients that enrolled in the CARMA trial. There were samples that were obtained for these 125 patients. What they're able to see is 4 time points at month 1, month 3, month 6, and month 12. They looked at the MRD negativity rates. They looked at the serological responses. This is to define what is the impact, the prognostic impact of attaining an MRD negativity? So the first question that they asked is, like, is there any concordance between the next generation flow, next generation sequencing? Is one better than the other? So there was significant concordance of greater than 65% across all the group, the highest concordance at this month 6 at more than 80%. Contrary to what they were looking for in terms of the good prognostic impact, they found that if patients did not achieve an MRD negativity at 10 to the power of minus 6 at month 1, so that came with a high negative prognostic impact. So patients who had MRD positivity at month 1, the median PFS was 2 months versus MRD negativity at 10 to the power of minus 6, the median PFS was 11.5 months. So there is utility for using MRD negativity at month 1 here. This is an early prognostic marker suggesting a negative impact if the patient is MRD positive. The second thing that they looked at was if the patients achieved greater than a CR and MRD negativity, both of them happening simultaneously at month 3, 6, and 12, they're the ones that tend to be the long-term good players. The third one is reappearance of normal plasma cells. They talked about when the normal plasma cells come back, this is overcoming what the CAR-T functionality is, what the CAR-T persistence is. So that provided a negative impact. So patients progress a little early when that happens. So those are the three take-home messages that I could give from this paper.
So sometimes I wonder if I'm the last person to hear about stuff, but I thought that thing about the normal plasma cells was really cool, and I hadn't heard about it previously. Joe, you were talking about the issue of when CAR-T fits, and of course we saw this press release. We're waiting to see the data from CARMA 3 using it earlier. Any thoughts about when we're going to see this data and how you think it's going to affect practice? Right now, having to wait for 4 lines of therapy seems really late. I kind of wonder, bispecifics now are going to complicate it even more. So it depends on which one comes first, bispecifics or CAR T. But to me, like if you're resistant to PI, IMiD, and anti-CD38, I'm not sure how much more longer you want to wait for at least one of the two.
I completely agree. And I think it's going to happen. I think in light of the discussion we had earlier about drug approval, the standard is going to be higher. I mean, thankfully, CAR T has shown such tremendous response even in these earlier phases. And, you know, it was interesting. Their whole series even presented at ASH, at, you know, looking at people, for example, who had relapsed within 18 months of starting therapy, you know, that highest risk people, highest risk patient, even phenotypically. So when we're going to hear, I think it's going to take a little bit longer, Neil, because we're going to see the readout on this. But, you know, the FDA is going to appropriately set a higher bar for when we're going to bring, because the number of patients eligible, the potential use of it, as you've said, especially now we're using more quads. So people are going to have, you know, there could be triple class refractory after two lines of therapy now. And so I think there is a justification using it earlier, even biologically, because I think the T cells, when they're a little less beaten down, you know, these soldiers are not at the end of their career. They're earlier on. We may be able to engage them for longer. And then lastly, as you sort of indicated, I know we're going to come to bispecifics. You know, we always get asked the question, is it going to be CAR T? Is it going to be bispecifics? My favorite answer to almost every question is all of the above, right? And that's what we want. We want them both, because some people are going to be better suited for CAR T. Some people are going to be better suited and more available for bispecifics. I think the major hurdle bispecifics will have to come over is really being able to fully give it in the community and not to have, you know, step up dosing in an academic center. If we can figure that out, then it's going to be much, much more accessible. And I think more and more patients are going to benefit from these therapies much earlier in the disease course. But I think of using CAR T in, you know, 1 to 3 prior lines, that's probably not going to happen this calendar year. But, you know, I'm happy to be surprised if it happens, because it is going to take a little while to fully prove that.
So Ajay also in his talk goes through the more recent data on Cilta-cel, the other approved CAR T product. I also want to ask you about this CAR T that targets GPRC5D, which we're going to talk about in a second, is also the target of a bispecific. Anything you want to say, Ajay, about where things stand with that agent? Seems very interesting. What's been seen so far is a different target for CAR T.
It is a different target. So this is heavily expressed on, expressed on the myeloma cells and the hard keratinized tissues. So the side effect profile that you see with this specific agent could be slightly different than the BCMA targeted therapies. So the infection potential or the infection risk is much lower by targeting this agent. Number two, the skin related changes and the dysgeusia are the taste and the change in the taste were the two common side effects that were seen. So other than that, at the 5 dose cohorts that were evaluated, all the way from 25 million cells to 450 million cells, you're able to see the MTD has not exceeded. And typically, for patients who have received more than 100 million cells, the overall response rate was 100%. So this is, again, early data, early snapshot of 33 patients, and among patients that had seen a prior BCMA-directed therapy, the overall response rate are beyond the 80% mark. So all of these suggest that this drug could definitely be expanded, developed, and with minimal toxicities.
Joe, any thoughts about the skin dysgeusia and nail changes? I think it's also seen with the bispecific, where I kind of wonder how that's going to play out, since that maybe is going to be longer-term therapy. I guess a reminder that CAR T is not necessarily only going to have CRS and neurologic toxicity. How much of an issue do you think these other problems are going to be with this target?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're learning there's no perfect target, right? I mean, you trade off maybe, as Ajay said, a little bit less infection for some of these other issues. I do think that we're going to get better at managing it. I think we already are now compared to where we were 6 months ago. I mean, look, Neil, where we were a year ago in CRS and where we are now, right? In terms of both preventing it and managing it. So I'm not belittling it, because I've had some patients who really struggle. I mean, the dyschezia is no fun, and some people with their hair changes and nail changes, it can be, in their view, very disfiguring. And so I don't want to minimize that, but I think we are going to get better at managing it, both preventing it with the right dosing and the dosing strategies. And also we're learning about some interventions that may be able to help. So I think it's going to be a factor, but I think the benefit of having a different target, as we see now, that although we can go BCMA to BCMA, it's preferable to go to a different target. I think that benefit is going to outweigh some of these risks, and we're going to get better at managing them.
So kind of takes me a lot to get excited, but I'm getting pretty excited about bispecifics, not just in myeloma, but also lymphoma. And actually, it's interesting, Jay, I was actually doing an interview of a patient who was on had been on teclistamab for a year and a half on a trial the day the drug was approved, doing great, no symptoms. I was just like, what a great endorsement of be participating in clinical research. But it's approved. Docs in practice are asking, are we going to be given this in the near future? Can you kind of summarize what we know in terms of efficacy, tolerability, and the very important practical question of how are community-based general medical oncologists going to be involved in the delivery of bispecifics?
That's great. So, Neil, this was one of the things that excited me as well. So, because you're waiting for so long for these CAR-Ts, and having the ability to get an off-the-shelf agent that gives almost similar response rates and the similar benefit, this was really promising for me. So the teclistamab was approved in October of this year. So basically, based on the MajesTEC-1 trial that treated 165 patients, and the drug is given subcutaneously, and the drug is given as priming doses for two doses before patients get the target dose, which is the first dose. So the REMS program that was designed for this specific agent means that every patient should be admitted in the hospital for 48 hours after receiving the first priming dose and the second priming dose and the first dose. So why do we do that? So there is risk of CRS that was seen predominantly in the first three doses, the two priming doses and the first dose. And to minimize that risk, this risk evaluation in the mitigation program has been incorporated. So after that, the patient could be receiving the drug as an outpatient once a week. And as Joe suggested, we potentially can make our own changes down the line, but at this point it is approved on a weekly basis. So what did we see in terms of the adverse events when it was given at the priming doses and the scheduled doses on a weekly basis? There was significant increased risk of infections that we alluded to before. So the grade 3 risk of infections was in the range of around 40%. So that is not a small number. So now that we're incorporating a lot of prophylaxis, antibiotic prophylaxis, giving IVIG for these patients, we expect to see those numbers to drop down drastically. Using that antiviral prophylaxis, antibacterial prophylaxis, and antifungal prophylaxis as well as PJP prophylaxis for these patients, at least until the time we're much safer and we're able to space this drug, is much crucial, as we see. Coming to your last point of how can we see this roll out into the community. So at this point of time, as a commercial agent, we're getting our hands wet. So we're getting our feet wet. We're getting used to giving this drug in the hospital for the first month or two. And once that first few months are completed, we'll safely be able to hand over this patient to the community. So at this point of time, where the community has not seen management of CRS firsthand, this probably would be the best idea. But as Joe suggested, 6 months down the line, we are fast learners and we had seen lots of changes, and we soon can see this happening in the community.
So Ajay also went through some other bispecifics in his talk, ABV-383, and also alnuctamab. Any thoughts about bispecifics in general? At this point, can you differentiate anything about them in terms of efficacy, tolerability? And again, your projection, and, you know, what are we going to be talking about a year from now, a year in review, 2023, in terms of bispecifics, Joe?
Yeah, no, I think there are, you know, 18 ways to cut this pie. I've kept it pretty simple. I like to say right now, we really have four different bispecifics. Number one, the BCMA-directed bispecifics. And whether it's teclistamab, elratinab, ABBV, to be honest, they're very similar. They have response rates somewhere between 60 and 70%. We can make some differentiations based on how frequently they're given, but realistically, and the Regeneron product, but realistically right now, it seems they're very similar in terms of CRS infections. Again, some differences based on step-up dosing and how much time people spend in hospital, let's say with elratinab, because you will be discussing that next year, because that may be the next BCMA directed bispecific that will be approved. Category two are the GPRC5Ds like talquetamab that you have up here. You'll be talking about this next year, Neil, because it may likely be approved in this calendar year. And we've talked already a bit about how it targets the cell differently and has different toxicities. The third category would be those that target FCRH5, which are a little bit further behind, although they've been there for a while. So we may not see them approved this year. If you're doing your year in review for 2024, you may be talking about FCRH5. And then for your year in review 24 or maybe even 2025, the final category are NK cell engagers, so natural killer cell engagers, as opposed to T cell engagers as bispecifics. And the Neil, why I want to emphasize that, you know, I just started a patient today on, I think we're on the ninth cohort of our NK engager study, and it's amazing. She's being treated exclusively as an outpatient. So the risk of CRS is so low, these patients actually don't have to be admitted for their treatment. And that's going to be much more, I think, feasible to bring into the community. Now, granted, they may not have the same efficacy as the T-cell engagers based on the functioning of an NK cell, but I think there's a lot of hope for the future. So I would differentiate them based on what is their target, both on the myeloma cell and on the immune cell, into those four categories. But you're going to be talking bispecifics, bispecifics, bispecifics for the next several years, boss.
Nine NK cells. I haven't heard that one before. Here's the talquetamab. I just want to point out, I have a list of favored trial names with GLOW, Cleopatra, but I like this one, Monumental One. That's optimistic.
Well, let me tell you, our NK one is the Trinket study, with the NK in the middle being Trinket, and not bad.
Oh, cool. I like it. All right, CELMoDs. AJ, you know, I feel like we've been hearing about CELMoDs forever. Like, where are they? And of course, you and Remember, you've done a lot of work on that. Ibertamide, we saw some more data this year on that fascinating agent. I don't know if you call this MESI, but, you know, another cereblon E3 ligase modulator or CELMoD. Any comments about these agents? What's your experience been, Ajay?
So both the ibertamide as well as the mezigdomide, so these are CELMoDs, the cereblon E3 ligase modulators. They bind to cereblon at much, much higher affinity than what you see with the pomalidomide and the lenalidomide. What we're able to see was these can be in among these patients that are penta-refractory, that had seen five prior lines of therapy, and you're still able to see with an oral agent, you're able to see response rates in the range of 30% or beyond. So the toxicity, when you look at these specific agents, this is easily manageable, and the toxicities are mostly neutropenia and hematological toxicities, and potentially the way that I see this is these could be used as either combination treatments or as maintenance treatments down the line. When we want to develop post-CAR T maintenance, these could be potentially as a viable agent in this space.
Joe, any thoughts? And also, I thought this is interesting, the impact in extramedullary disease. I don't know why it would work better there, but, you know, 31% response rate. Any thoughts about where CELMoDs are heading, Joe?
Yeah, no, I think Ajay captured it nicely. I mean, despite all the excitement of the big, potent, you know, CAR T cell therapies and bispecifics, they're very involved and they're going to be challenging to give. I mean, these are perhaps some of the most tolerated agents we've ever had in myeloma. So thinking about the fact that still the majority of patients with myeloma are over the age of 65, you know, we have a lot of frail patients that are not going to be able to experience some of these novel treatments. So being able to have these, I think they're going to make their way earlier. You know, as Ajay mentioned, we have both iberdomide and mezigdomide, which are likely ultimately going to be the replacements for lenalidomide and pomalidomide. So they're going to prove themselves in this relapse space by themselves. They're going to be used in combination and they're going to be brought earlier in the disease course. And I think they're going to fit into those niches that we're all going to still have, as you've mentioned, with these patients becoming progressive on immunomodulatory drugs. I'm not totally convinced with the extramedullary disease yet. I think people define that in different ways and it's a bit more broad category. I'm not trying to naysay it, Neil. I'm just saying I think we need a little bit more time to make that deep conclusion.
I just thought it was really cool. I haven't heard about that. Mm-hmm. So selinexor, lots of questions from docs in practice about how to give it. You know, they try it once and they have problems with it. Ajay reviewed this paper looking at selinexor called frilzimib dexamethasone. Joe, what's your experience with selinexor and what do you think about this regimen?
I got to tell you, I use Selly every day in the clinic. I think this is an extraordinary agent. You know, Ajay and I have written papers about this. Short version, this drug should be given weekly. This drug is actually probably best given at 60 or 80 milligrams weekly, either whether it's by itself or in combination with just about everything else. My favorite partner is carfilzomib, like you've shown in this paper. And key things to remember, the worst month is the first month. So it's really important in that first month that patients get that two-fold antiemetics. I give them a 5-HT3 antagonist and olanzapine. And I find that that helps with both the sort of stomach nausea and head nausea, as I call it. We hydrate them. We make sure we get them through that first month, and then the drug is much more tolerable. And now the drug is showing that it can partner with bortezomib, carfilzomib, pomalidomide, daratumumab, and all four of those now are listed on NCCN.
And, of course, this is the Boston study that preceded that carfilzomib study. You got a lot of people thinking about using it in a partnership with bortezomib. Jay, again, what's your thought, you know, particularly in terms of quality of life? Are most patients able to, you know, have a good quality of life? And, I mean, do you see responses the way Joe's just described?
Absolutely. I think when you're looking at how to deliver the treatment, as Joe clearly emphasized, how to deliver the drug is the most important thing here. Once a week delivery at 60 milligrams in combinations, 80 milligrams in with Dex. But my go-to regimen is that 60 milligrams, if you're giving once a week, along with bortezomib once a week, you're able to see those responses in the long run. In the Boston trial, there is a clear PFS benefit that was seen favoring the combination.
So final paper, and when I saw the title of this one, I was like, ah, yeah, I like this idea. So, oops, sorry, went the wrong way. So venetoclax, Joe, lots of interest in that, particularly, of course, in 1114. We've been through that whole story over the last couple of years. But venetoclax and daratumumab index kind of sounds like a good quality of life approach. Looks like pretty decent response data. Any thoughts about this ASH paper?
Yeah, no, I think we're going to see a significant surge of venetoclax in this calendar year. Probably late in the year, we may even see it approved in patients with translocation 1114. And like with everything else, it should be able to be partnered. Both the efficacy signal and the concerning safety signal is pointing us in the direction of using this only in patients with translocation 1114, but it is feasible to combine. I've combined it with DARA. I've combined it with carfilzomib. I've combined it with bortezomib. And so in that subset of patients, and this is a reminder, when patients are diagnosed with myeloma and even at relapse, if it wasn't carefully done the first time, get the FISH analysis. See if patients are translocation 1114, because this is a great option for these patients. Maybe it's only 10, 15% of the total of our patients, maybe slightly higher than that. But maybe it's not a massive percentage, but it's a significant percentage. And it is more common within the African-American population. So it is, I think, worthy for us to get this information, because I have so many patients that are taking this oral therapy and they're doing really well without having, you know, significant toxicity.
So final comment from AJ Nicholas in the chat room wants to know, do you need to be concerned about tumor lysis syndrome? I'll add in, how much of an issue is cytopenias? And in general, what's your experience been? What line of therapy, Jay, and what kind of combination do you generally use?
So I'll answer the first question. So line of therapy, we usually use if somebody has 11-14, even as the second line therapy. We have not used as a front line, but early relapse, we have used the venetoclax in patients with translocation 11-14. So our institution has expertise to look for the ex vivo testing, to look for the sensitivities, so that really helps us from a basic science perspective. So coming to the question of the tumor lysis, it's very clear that unlike the CLL experience, unlike the other experiences, we don't see the tumor lysis in myeloma. So we had been extremely careful about watching those initial weeks with starting at the lower doses. This does not need a ramp up. We go with 400 milligrams to start with. After month one, we go double it to 400 BID. So this does not need a ramp up, but for the reinforcement for that we are doing the right thing for the patient, I typically bring the patient after 48 to 72 hours after starting the 400 milligram dosing, and I've never seen a tumor lysis with venetoclax in myeloma.
So Ajay and Joe, thank you so much for joining us today. Everybody learned so much. Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back tomorrow night. We'll see what Dr. Piotrowska and Dr. Raleigh have to say about lorlatinib first line in ALK, KRAS G12C, and the role of TDXD in lung cancer. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Joe. Thanks, Ajay.
Thank you.
Thank you.